Unconventional Life, the show where twice a week I interview successful entrepreneurs, artists, creatives, and thought leaders on how they earn their living in non-traditional ways. Each of these individuals are at the top of their game in terms of revenue and reach in their respective industry, living life in the driver's seat beyond what is traditional or predictable. On this show, you will learn how they took the path less traveled, what their revenue model looks like, and why they are prioritizing their passion over their paycheck.
It means living a life of passion and purpose.
And what would it look like if you create it from the ground up?
Everything that's shown up in my business has been a place for me to grow or expand as a human being.
I pretty much get paid to be me.
Very frequently, the exact things you think are against you might be the things that are actually the reason you can make it.
I'm your host, Jewel Schroeder.
If you would like to win this week's prize giveaway from our show guests featuring free access to their online courses, books, and other impactful tools to help you on the path to living an unconventional life, simply subscribe to the podcast on iTunes now and go to unconventionallifeshow.com to let us know you did. You can also get a second entry by leaving us an iTunes review.
Unconventional Life, welcome. This is your host, Jewel Schroeder, tuning in from the beautiful Boulder, Colorado today. We have got a very special guest on the line. I've got Kaylin Richardson from Park City, Utah. Kaylin, are you ready to take us down the path less traveled?
I totally am. Thank you so much for having me. This is exciting.
Yes, amazing. So Kaylin is a two-time Olympian skier who has a passion for new opportunities, which transcends her love for the mountains. And she's dedicated to forever expanding her expertise. So like I said, Kaylin started as a pro skier, pro ski racer, and then has moved into free skiing. She's also a television personality, broadcaster, speaker, writer, and entertainer, amongst many other things. I first met her through Vail's Epic Race contest that they had a few years ago, and super excited to have her on the show. So Kaylin, welcome to Unconventional Life. Go ahead and fill in any gaps that I might have left out and give us a glimpse into your personal life.
A glimpse into my personal life. Yeah, let's get into it. Let's get into the nitty gritty. I think that people always are somewhat interested in how I managed to make this whole life come together. And a lot of it is just sort of going with opportunities and being really open. So I grew up in Minneapolis. I now live in Park City, Utah because I love the mountains. But even growing up in Minnesota, it's so much my fabric. Was a ski racer on the small molehills, made the US ski team at 15, raced for 10 years. And then every single step, it's been really deliberate, where whenever people are sort of stuck in a stagnant place, I always ask them, why just stay where you are? Like, even if you make a choice, you're going in a direction that ultimately you figure out it's not the right choice, it's still progress. So even if you like go down, you're like, hey, I want to be a circus performer, maybe 6 months down the road, you think, this is not for me. At least you can check that off the list of things to try, because I think far too often people become frozen because they don't know which direction to go. And especially when you're young and there's so many different opportunities. Like, I've been reading a lot recently about choice and happiness and how those two relate. And sometimes because there is so much out there, it can almost be too much. It can be overwhelming.
Yeah, totally. Well, I love everything that you're saying, especially in line with our theme for unconventional life. And I know for those listening, you know, you did hear it right. You know, Kaylin, at 15, you were in the Olympics. Which is, or, you know, training for
that. I was training for it.
Training for the Olympics. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Which, I made my first Olympics when I was 21, but it was definitely an interesting route, because when I first made the US, a lot of skiers, especially racers, come from a bit of a pedigree where their parents were racers or pro athletes or ski patrollers even, or ski instructors. That was definitely not my family. It was a little bit more serendipitous, where my dad especially loved skiing, but racing had never even been on his radar in the smallest amount. And there was just a teeny tiny hill that we grew up near that's like 175 foot vertical. When people in the West Coast complain, where they're like, I only go out unless there's 6 inches of fresh, I'm like, you should talk to the people in the Midwest that drive 3+ hours for like 200 vertical and ice, because those are the people that really love it. But as I get off on a tangent, it was just one of those things where I didn't necessarily grow up drawing pictures of myself on the top of an Olympic podium. It was just that I really loved skiing, and I actually loved the social part of it. And it was something that I had a natural talent for. So that's always something I think people should be willing to explore, and just kept moving up the ranks. And I think that a lot of times kids can get stuck in inertia. My parents were really great at every step of the way saying, is this something you really want to do? Because there's so much to do in this life.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I know some of our listeners are younger based, and especially being in Colorado, being in such a community of skiers and snowboarders, same with you in Park City. For someone that's listening, what advice could you give them if they have this path that might be centered specifically around like the pro athlete track at a young age? Like, what could you say to them on their journey?
I would say, especially for those that are young, have a passion for it. Even it's interesting because when you are good at something, I think a lot of times people say, well, why wouldn't you do that? But maybe you don't. Maybe you just happen to be really good at it. But as far as the pro athlete, whether it's, you know, going to like the Olympic caliber or a free skiing world tour or any other sport where there is a sort of outlet that is at the zenith of that sport, if that's your goal, I definitely say pursue it. And the one thing I would say is, as you continue to pursue it, every so often, just take a little bit of an inventory. Say, write down your goals. And it can be a little bit disheartening. For years, for a very large majority of my life, every year, multiple times a year, I would look at my goals and see if I was anywhere near them or if I had exceeded them. And that sometimes is a good marker, because I'm a pragmatist as well, where I wouldn't necessarily tell someone that's a dreamer, if it's not happening for them, if they're just hitting their head against the wall and saying it's just not happening. There's so much out there. And I've talked to a lot of young athletes that are in transition, which I went through after retiring, which is a euphemism for quitting from an elite sport. But it's one of those things where a lot of times people don't know what to do in that transition. And I always go, what interests you? What fires you up? And a lot of times when people have been so sort of a tunnel of their whole existence has been that one endeavor, whether it's sports, academics, business, especially if someone has reached a goal, sometimes it's hard because at such a young age, you're like, I've even talked to some people that have had a mad amount of success in like Silicon Valley, where at 30 something, they sell a company for a huge amount of money. And then it's kind of like, what now? Mm-hmm. But the good thing is that there really is endless possibilities.
Yeah, I love it. And we'll totally get into that transition more. And I know for those that are listening, specifically the world of being in the Olympics at 21, being so clear, you know, as you were saying, checking in, is this something every step of the way that I am aligned with, that I feel passionate about? So what was it like being in the Olympics at 21, and how did you know? Like, what was your gauge for like, okay, this is it for me? And then how did you mentally prepare to be in such a high performance environment?
The life of an elite ski racer is very regimented, in that if I was still ski racing, I could pretty much lay out almost day to day what I'm doing for the next calendar year. And it sounds, sometimes that sounds not that great. And there was great parts of it. And obviously there was nuances to different things, but I knew that, for instance, in June and July, I'm really in the gym. And then August, we're in New Zealand. And September, we're in Chile. And October, we're in the glaciers in Europe. So, and it's funny, when you list off all those things, they're like, oh, rough life. When you've been doing it for 10 years, there starts to be not a monotony, but there's not a spontaneity. And that's kind of what I craved when I finally decided to walk away from my race boards. But at 21, it was really interesting because I kind of have to go back to when I was a senior in high school. When I first made the ski team, I was the national development team, so the junior national team. And I was definitely sort of the underdog, where everyone's like, who is this girl? She's a goofball. She's from a teeny tiny hill. Where is she from? Like, what's her name? And so I kind of just kept moving up the ranks. And then I had my breakout year when I was 17, 18. And that was the first time as a senior in high school where I was like, gosh, 2006. And that was the 2002-2003 winter, where I was like, that could be something I could potentially make. And that kind of was like a light bulb, because like I said earlier, I wasn't a kid that was like this wunderkind. Like, I grew up with Lindsey Vonn, and if people know that name, she was from the get-go a phenom. Like, people knew she was going places. I was like, we're the same age, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna go make a snowman, when she was beating kids 4 and 5 years older than her. So I kind of just kept slowly moving up the ranks, and then that senior year, I started beating people in the World Cup. I raced my first World Cup, and that's when I was like, oh, the college thing, which my mom's a teacher, and I am a huge proponent of academics, but that was the year where I was like, I'm going to take a year off and really pursue ski racing without having to deal with high school or any kind of school and see what happens. And then, obviously, you know, 3 years later, I went to Torino at 21, and that was really cool. The coolest thing about the Olympics is that it is the only place I've been where every single person wants to be there. Like, you'll go to different events where there'll be someone that's just too cool and is like, oh, this isn't that neat, or they'll say, you know, something else fell through. But at the Olympics, when you are about to walk into the opening ceremonies for the Parade of Nations, every single person in there has worked and sacrificed, and they wouldn't want to be anywhere else in the world. And that energy is seriously electric. Yeah. So I feel really lucky to have been able to experience that.
Yeah, amazing. Were you ever intimidated? You know, you talk about Lindsey Vonn being the same age and then just like going into like a big, you know, I imagine a big fish pond being in the Olympics, standing there like, okay, this is like what I've worked for. Like, what was that like?
So the Olympics is interesting because it's pretty much the best of the World Cup field. So there wasn't anyone at the Olympics that I wasn't completely familiar with, whether I was familiar with beating them or getting beat by them. So it wasn't necessarily the people you were with that was intimidating. It was that you were on this world stage. And it's interesting. You talk to different sports psychologists, and there's different schools of thought where some people are like, it's just another race. Like, just ski your race. And there is some truth to that, where you don't want to get so nervous. You don't want to get so caught up in things that you make a huge mistake or do something dumb. But at the same time, it is different. Like, you can't pretend that it's not the biggest race in the world and it's only 4 years and the world is watching and all that kind of thing. So you kind of have to try to find that balance. And for me, I think that I probably erred on the side of being like, it's just another race, because I wasn't a favorite. Like, for me, the huge accomplishment was being on the national team. That was, or being on the Olympic team, rather. So that just making it there was, you know, in qualifying was such a dream come true, that the rest was kind of gravy. I still wanted to do really well. I still wanted to do my best. And there was an offside chance I could have done something amazing and had the race of my career. But for me, I just really relished the experience.
Yeah, awesome. So amazing stuff that you're talking about there. You know, I'm also really drawn to this part about the transition, which is, you know, what you've mentioned. And so you did that for 10 years. You basically hit this peak of like, okay, I qualified. I made it to the Olympics, had the race that you had. And then what happened next? How did you move from that place?
So after Torino, it was such a cool experience. And that was my best season pretty much ever, where after the Olympics, I still skied really fast. And or actually the next season was really good, but I was on this really good, like, crescendo. There was really good momentum going after that season. So I was like, you know, it's cooler than being an Olympian. It was a two-time Olympian. So at that point, I kind of made a commitment to going for another 4 years. And it's interesting, because like with a lot of athletes that are in Olympic sports, especially those lesser known, and ski racing does have a big fan base, but it's not, you know, it's not like the American sports like football, baseball, hockey, all those ones. So a lot of times you'll see a lot of people retire after an Olympic year, that kind of thing. So I was like, I want to go through Vancouver. And especially when we knew that the Olympics were going to be right in our backyard in Vancouver, that was a huge goal of mine, where I was like, I would love to be there. I would be able to have the opportunity to have so many friends and family be there, which would be really special. And I was skiing really fast, and I was definitely still very passionate about racing. So went for another 4 years, ups and downs for sure. A lot of learning in that 4 years from you know, 21 to 25. But I managed to make Vancouver. When I qualified, it was a huge, I remember I just broke down and cried, because it was like there was so much pressure. There was so much unknown going into that season. I wasn't necessarily skiing my best. There were like moments of brilliance, but it's the Olympic, the season moving up to an Olympic season is very, very tough mentally. So I qualified. It was a huge thing. I had 26 family and friends go and watch me in Vancouver in my event.
Nice.
And that was one of those things where when I finished Vancouver, it was such a cool experience, and it was beautiful because I kind of really had this outlook where I could really take it all in, where I was very present, because I sort of knew, and deep in my heart, I hadn't even said it out loud to anyone, where I was like, I think I'm done with ski racing at this point. And I was still skiing relatively fast, but I didn't have that drive. And if you're going to do something that is that taxing, takes that much time, that much mental strength, you really have to want it. And I would see that in my other teammates, where I'm like, they want it more than I do. And I potentially could have kept ski racing, but just to finish in the middle of the pack on World Cups and stuff, like, I didn't want that. So at that point, one thing, people are always like, well, how did you know? And I was like, well, I just made that decision. I think that once you make that decision, you just have to move forward. So I knew, I announced my retirement that spring, did my last little swan song of races, and it was really wonderful. And I love the people I was around. I still am very involved with the US ski team. I still commentate for NBC. That was really cool this last season, being able to watch a lot of the races that I'd skied. And the nice thing is there was a bit of an interim where I wasn't as involved with ski racing. There was always different little projects I would do, but actually to talk about the technical aspect of ski racing, that kind of thing was fun to do, and be able to tell the stories of the athletes that I knew was really neat. But the big part too is that I wanted to ski for me. Mm-hmm. When it really comes down to it, as far as the transition, where I was like, I knew that the racing, I didn't have the drive, but I still had the passion for the sport.
Yeah.
And there's so many different avenues of skiing that I wanted to explore. Like, I'd heard about this backcountry thing. I'd been touring once. I really want to try this out. And so I sort of had this unformed vision of what, you know, the next 4 years, instead of, you know, gearing up for Sochi, I was like, I made a little goal where I was like, I would love to be in Sochi doing some sort of TV. That'd be great. If it didn't happen, not a big deal. But if it happened, that would be amazing. And that did end up happening. I went with the Weather Channel, and I was their Special Olympic correspondent, which was really great. So I still got to be in Sochi, still got to be involved, but did one free skiing competition, aligned with Helly Hansen, which was amazing. At the time, I was with Icelandic, which was great, the ski company. And I kind of just put it out there and pursued different things and really worked at it. People always are like, how did you make this happen? And I was like, well, you definitely have to make phone calls. You have to make emails. You have to learn and ask questions.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting what you're talking about. It's essentially going from this background of having one clear definitive goal for 4 years. And you're literally like, when you're doing the Olympic training, it's like everything that you're doing is living, breathing, working towards this event, this goal. And then to go through that cycle twice in a row, and for those listening, you know, talk about having delayed gratification, is that you're literally like for 4 years working at something and not getting to experience like the fruits of your labor. So for those that are listening, highlighting that. But then also to then leave that and then to know, okay, my passion for this sport is here. This form of expression isn't resonating. And to go in this completely unstructured way of experiencing gratification. Like, how is that for you mentally?
That's a really good way of putting it, that I went from pretty much the most rigid manifestation of the sport to the most loose and expressive of the sport. And I would say that going back to the first part of the question with that delayed gratification part, it can be really tough because 4 years is a long time. And there are a lot of people that weren't as lucky as me to have made two Olympics that are great racers and great athletes. And then the timing didn't work or injury came. If anyone's at all familiar with ski racing, there's so much injury and it's heartbreaking. And I think that for anyone in any kind of field or project, that is that long, where it really is, you have to continue to keep that drive. And it's breaking it down into smaller things. Like, there were still two world championships between every Olympics, which is still a huge event, especially within the skiing community, the ski racing community. The Olympics is the one that transcends all sport. For instance, I was in Africa shortly after I retired from ski racing, and I was trying to explain to these kids what ski racing was, and they'd never seen snow before. So for them to fathom what I did on skis was really hard to translate. But when I said I was an Olympian, there was a light bulb. And they couldn't understand what I'd done in my sport, like what I'd physically done, but the figurative sense of what I'd been able to accomplish in my country and in the world as being one of the best, they understood that, which was really a gift. And it is a gift to be a part of that whole legacy. But the delayed gratification, you just have to enjoy the process. Like, if someone was to go into something saying, in 4 years, my life will be over if I don't make this, you know, if it doesn't happen, I'm like, if you're not going to enjoy the process and you're not going to be able to live in the moment, wasting 3.5 years of your life for like that 6 months up to the Olympics and to compete in that, it's so trivial and it's so tough, because like ski racing, like, who's going to remember? Like, no one remembers me. No one's like, oh my gosh. Like, yes, if you get to be to the point where your household name, like a Bodie Miller, Lindsey Vonn, Julie Mancuso, then yes, there's, I guess that's a different thing. But for me, it was really about, I loved being on tour, like traveling and ski racing. And that was really fun. And I thought it was so great. And then, and it wasn't that it wasn't great when I was done. It was more that I just really wanted to explore other things because I'd done it for a long time. I kind of knew what that was all about. And so to be able to go into the skiing world, it's great. I recently signed with Vocal, which is the company I skied in both Olympics with. And when we did the announcement, I'm holding my race skis from Vancouver. And then on the other hand, I'm holding these big fat skis. And just the illustration of, especially a company that I have such a great relationship with, that I went from these teeny little race boards, you know, that people are like, oh, that can't... Like people from the free skiing world are like, that doesn't even look fun. And I'm like, oh my gosh, slalom skis are so much fun. And then of course, people from the ski racing world are like, those are so fat. And I'm like, well, wait a second. These are so much fun. So it's just one of those things where I wanted to, that was something that really interested me. And like, I've always loved Warren Miller and it always been a huge, there'd always been like this little pipe dream where I'm like, it'd be so cool to be in a Warren Miller movie. You know, it just would be neat. I don't even know how people do that. And through a couple different things happening, with different resorts and companies I've been with, I got to be in a Warren Miller movie. And this will be my fifth. And I'm going to be in Deer Valley, which is my home now at the St. Regis. And being able to show people what I get to do on the day-to-day in this coming movie that will come out in October, that's such a cool gift. So the cool thing for me is that I've gotten to look at this huge microcosm of skiing and really enjoy so many different parts of it. Where I've sat on the top of a World Cup downhill and looked out over this vista of the Austrian Alps and been like, I'm about to go 80 plus miles an hour down this manicured slope, right? That is like bulletproof, but it will be amazing. And then I've also stood on top of mountains that in Norway where I'm going to ski down to the ocean and it's just me and I've hiked this whole mountain. And as much as those are disparate experiences, there is something that's very much the same, and trying to find that focus. And that's what's been really fun about the big mountain skiing is that you do have to still find that focus. Like I still get to tap in to that part of my psyche where you have to be ultra focused and it's all about the task at hand.
Yeah. Awesome. I love it. I love hearing the way that you talk about the different worlds of both of them. And sometimes I think it can be easy for those listening to feel like it has to be this either or thing. And it seems like you've been able to combine like the best of everything that you've been doing, which is awesome. And so for those listening, like I want to get into the revenue and the money side of it a little bit, because often, you know, there's this notion that you want to pursue what you're passionate about. So leaving the world of like Olympian ski racing, I don't know the specifics, but I would imagine the money details are more calculated at that point and you know what you're going to get and it's more predictable. Then going to the other side, it's like, okay, what do I do? Do I get sponsors? How do I make these connections? So how do you make the money side of it work now being this like independent agent, if you will, or how do you even start to make, how do you create some stability amongst like a world of uncertainty?
Absolutely. With the US ski team, I was really lucky that the US ski team supported all our travel, like took care of that. And then when you're a ski racer, much like anything, you'll get a retainer, which is sort of like a salary, and then you'll work kind of on commission, which they call a victory schedule. So you'll get like your retainer, which is like, okay, I'm guaranteed this money for the year. They'll have injury clauses. It depends. All contracts are different. But then the victory schedule is where it can become very fruitful, where if you get first in a World Cup, it's X amount. And it kind of depends. Like if it's someone that wins really regularly, it's probably a lesser amount than someone that if they won, it would be a huge deal. I mean, that's just common sense. And you're right. In that part of my life, it was very, I just had to focus on the racing and I didn't have many expenses. So it was just, it's a simpler life. It for sure is. Like there are some times where I long, especially around August, because the trip to New Zealand was always my favorite because the ski season was still a long ways off. It was such a fun trip. New Zealand's amazing if anyone gets the chance to go there. But then as far as like a free skier, I have a lot of friends that were so generous with their time. I'd ask them questions. I was like, how do you accrue sponsors? Like, I'm not competing anymore. And how do they know what I'm capable of and like what my special skill set is and that kind of thing? So you become a freelancer is really what it comes down to. And the funny thing is you talk about stability. That can be a very big unknown where if you have relationships with companies, like Helly Hansen has been a great partner of mine, and I couldn't be happier with them. Just their brand, and they really live with passion for the, like, what they create. And so that's been one company that I know at the start of the year that I'll get some money from them that will help make ends meet. And then there might be some other projects. I might do some TV stuff, but it really depends. Winter is like my extremely busy season. This past winter was so busy, but there might be a 2-week period that it's not as busy. And that's when you catch up on things, and then it'll get incredibly busy. So it just like any kind of life of a freelancer, they get it, where you have to make hay while the sun shines. So there'll be sections of your life that are just beyond crazy, but then there'll also be times where you can go and relax, or like maybe go travel and that kind of thing. So I think you get paid in your lifestyle, where I would never say that what I've chosen necessarily hasn't been the most lucrative, but I've gotten to do, like, if I've been paid in my experience, that is priceless.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. So let's talk about the world of sponsorship for a minute. And so I know when I actually met you, I think the first time during the Epic Race, I was helping Icelandic, and Never Summer actually sponsored me with a bunch of stuff to go out there. And so since then, I've had a lot of friends that were like, oh, I saw you on the Never Summer website. Like, how did you do that? You know, like, how do you get someone to sponsor you? And so for those that are listening, how do you do that for the realm of like someone that wants to enroll someone, whether it's like skiing, we can use skiing as the model for sponsorship, but I think you can get sponsors for anything as a way to kind of like add and contribute to what you're up to. So give us like your world about sponsorship and how people could go about getting a sponsor, or just the types of like steps or components that you feel need to be there.
Absolutely. In this sort of climate right now with social media and the internet, it's definitely different, where anyone that writes an email to a company or a marketing officer at a company and says, I'm really awesome, like I ski really well, or I do this really well, sponsor me, you will not get far. Where, and I've even had people say that. They're like, I wrote an email and I sent them this sick edit. And I was like, well, you're halfway there, where you can show them that you're a really great skier and that you can create content. But just like pitch them that. Be like, hey, I create content. Like, if you give me a logo, I'll do like a really cool integration. It's just an amount of like finding what your skill set is and being able to, and it's hard because there's a really fine line with selling yourself, where it's tough, especially if you negotiate your own deals, which I primarily do, where you don't want to sound boastful, but you also want to be able to convey your worth, where a lot of times people are like, well, what's the easiest way to get a ski sponsor? And if they're being like rude or they're not listening to what I'm saying, I'm like, well, being a 2-time Olympian really helps. You go. But for those that, there are so many amazing skiers, like just skiing POW and Deer Valley, or like heading up to Elta and Snowbird, so many amazing skiers, where I'm like, find out like what you can do for them. I think that in any kind of business opportunity, instead of going in and being like, hey, do this for me, if you can go to them and be like, this is what I can do for you, and if you sort of preface it with that in mind, you will go far, you will go like a lot farther, because all of a sudden they're like, oh, this person's being really proactive, they have this many followers. Even if you don't have a lot of followers, say, hey, I think I have a really great relationship with these people and I can really connect with them, whether it's a different outlet, or maybe you live in a place where you have a certain cachet. It's all a matter of packaging. And I hate to say that because it sounds inauthentic, and it's not. It's just a matter of being able to communicate that, where a lot of times it is over email. Like, unless you live in a place like Park City or Boulder or someplace in the mountains, it's very rare that you will be in the same place as the company and can walk in their front door and say, hey, like, let's have this conversation face to face, and you'll really be able to connect with me and understand what I have. A lot of times you have to be able to write it or talk about it over the phone, and that's a lot harder to engage.
Yeah, totally. So for those that are listening, let's go even a little bit further. And let's say you are starting from scratch all over again, and you're wanting to get a sponsor. What would be like the step-by-step like you would do to basically either cold call a sponsor? Would you do some kind of research? Like, what would you send in an email? Like, what would be your process if you were starting from nothing again in approaching someone?
Absolutely. If I was starting from nothing, first step, put your computer away, rack your brain, or maybe look on your contact list. It's all about who you know. I think that as a species, as much as there's craziness happening in the world right now, deep down in the fabric of us, we want to help one another. and look at who you know who could give you advice, who could open a door, because even though we're in this e-commerce era, people want to work with people. You know, whether even maybe you have your whole relationship over the phone, they want to work with people, whether it's someone said they can vouch for you or you're a friend of a friend, even family stuff. I mean, there's plenty of nepotism in every single business. And I never cast stones because that hasn't been the case in my experience. But I'm just saying, look at your network. Think of someone that you know that has been able to do what you would like to do. And maybe you have somewhat of a tenuous connection. I would say 9 times out of 10, if you can make it worth, like if you can go to them, like, and also when you ask people for advice, again, like I said before, don't go to them being like, hey, can you help me? Think of something you could do for them. Like, it could be as easy as saying, hey, I've been an admirer of yours for a long time. What you've been able to do is amazing. I have a connection with this, or I've noticed on Instagram that you're repaving your garden. Like, I'd love to come help. Like, it could be as easy as that, because it's just like you're kind of showing that you're not just expecting something from them. Like, you'd like to give them something in return. I remember Chris Davenport. I was always a fan of him, and he and I are now really great friends. I've always really admired his business acumen and how he's been able to create this amazing career. And when we became friends through a couple different projects, I told him some things that I think he would be great for through different avenues that I have connections with. So when we first began that conversation, I could say, hey, I'd love to connect you with so-and-so. And then it just creates like it's like you're more equals, where it's not like you're just taking, you're also trying to give. So first, network, I would say, is the first thing. And then reaching out to people, seeing who, you know, those that are perceptive and those that maybe aren't, maybe they're just too busy. And then the next thing is taking the information they've had and utilizing it, whether they can help further that connection, where maybe you know someone that used to work for a company, like maybe they used to work like with athletics. Like, for instance, I work with this app called Pair Sports, which is amazing. They have connections with all the different kinds of avenues. Like, they have a relationship with Ragnar Run. Like, maybe I wanted to do a video series with Ragnar Run instead of me just writing an email to, you know, the website or whatever. I would go through Pair Sports, which is this awesome app that I do work with, and say, hey, like my friend there, I'd say, hey, Jacob, can you connect me with your contact there? Because then it's like all of a sudden you have a conduit that not only makes you more viable, but also it just helps you give a little bit of credibility.
Yeah, totally. Amazing gold advice for everyone that is listening. So let's transition into the last part of our show, which is the rapid fire round. So this is a series of questions that you don't know about that I am going to ask you. Are you ready?
I am racer ready.
Awesome. Okay, let's begin. So question number one, what is one thing that you have had to give up along the way in pursuit of going after what you want?
The college experience. As a ski racer, I'm still chipping away at my academic career, and I definitely would go visit friends in college, or even when I come across people that have these really strong bonds with friends from college, and I wouldn't do anything differently. But every once in a while, I was like, it would have been really cool to have that experience.
Awesome. All right, next question. What is one mental practice that you do, whether it was preparing for the downhill or if it's hiking big mountain and going down or something else? What is one mental practice that you have that you feel keeps you in the zone and in the game?
I would say being grateful for every single thing. That kind of like helps you like kind of slow things down, where it can become very frantic, and some, especially if like there's a helicopter involved, but just like be grateful for every moment. And also like just the fact of being like being grateful, like kind of puts you in the moment where you're like, I'm grateful for my life, for my health, all these kind of things, because sometimes people can make quicker decisions than they should. But even just in life in general, my life philosophy is laugh often and be grateful. So as long as like you're doing things that you derive joy from, you're probably going in the right direction.
Yeah. Love it. Awesome. All right. Next question. What is the worst advice you've ever received?
Ooh, don't be yourself. I remember there have been times where like people are like, you're a lot, like, and more or less in so many words, they say, be something other than yourself, whether you're going into a meeting or whatever. If you feel like you have to be something other than who you are to get a job, to get an opportunity, to make someone attracted to you, stop right there and run the other direction, because that is not the path you want to go down.
Yeah. Awesome. Pure gold. All right. Next question. What is something you know now that you wish you did when you were 20 years old? What would you say to your 20-year-old self if you had the opportunity to say something?
Relax. I still am pretty tightly wound. Pressure, especially, I'm thinking my 20-year-old self, where I don't necessarily give that advice to everyone, but knowing myself, I have high expectations. I put a lot of pressure on myself. I always try to bring an amount of levity to any situation, so I think people weren't necessarily always aware of that, but pressure can be crippling. And I would just tell my 20-year-old self, I really enjoyed it, don't get me wrong, but I just say, hey, relax. Like, it's all there. Just relax.
Yeah, awesome. And lastly, what does living an unconventional life mean to you?
Oh, man. Living an unconventional life for me is living with passion and with the desire to expand your experience.
Yeah, amazing. Awesome. Well, Kaylin Richardson, everyone. Kaylin, thanks so much for joining us. So for those that are listening, how can they stay in touch with you? How can they find out more about the work you're doing, watching the upcoming Warren Miller movie, whether it's you and Helly Hansen? How do they stay in touch?
I would say that my Facebook page, which is just facebook.com/KaylinFanpage. And I'm sorry, I know the fan pages are a troublesome, but it's a good way and a great platform. Also, Instagram. Instagram's my favorite social media outlet. I really enjoy it. And my handle's @KaylinRichardson. It's very, very easy. If you want to get in touch, shoot me a message on Kaylin fan page and we can delve into more. But if you just want to follow along on my journeys, on my travels, on the chicanery that is my life, Instagram is a great outlet for that.
Yeah, I love it. Well, Kaylin, once again, thank you so much. Unconventional Life family, thanks so much for tuning in to another great episode. We will talk to you all next time.
If you would like to win this week's prize giveaway from our show guests featuring free access to their online courses, books, and other impactful tools to help you on the path to living an unconventional life, simply subscribe to the podcast on iTunes now and go to unconventionallifeshow.com to let us know you did. You can also get a second entry by leaving us an iTunes review.